Hello, everyone. I'm Eric Golden, and welcome to Making Markets. This show explores the psychology and structure that make up markets all over the world. Each week, we speak to experts about a different market so you can see what actually happens when money changes hands. From mainstream stock and bond markets to esoteric niches like vineyards, antique art, and crypto, we explain the transactions that underpin our economy. Making Markets is part of the Colossus family of podcasts, and you can find all our podcasts, including edited transcripts, show notes, and other resources at joincolossus.com.
Eric Golden is the CEO of Canopy Capital. All opinions expressed by Eric and podcast guests are solely their own opinions and do not necessarily reflect the views of Canopy Capital. This podcast is for informational purposes and should not be construed or relied on as investment, legal, or tax advice. Clients of Canopy Capital may maintain positions in the securities discussed in this podcast, including positions that are contrary to the opinions offered.
All right, Mr. Golden, we are back. It is the two-year anniversary of the first quarterly recap, so celebrations all around. We'll have a big party at number 10, but something worth mentioning there. And to kick us off, as we always do, it was a strong quarter. 2024, just kicking us back into the roaring 20s. S&P was up over 10%. NASDAQ, very similar. Just felt like risk on appetite. What was your just immediate reaction to seeing the green on the screen in the early part of the year?
So I think that for risk assets, the year set up well. I don't think it was that surprising. People had a good 23 where the economy looked strong. There wasn't, as much as there's a lot of doomers and they get a lot of headlines, I think in the market participants, people were generally excited about coming into 24. And across both equities and bonds, the view was rates have normalized. And even though inflation, which we'll get into, is still sticky, people have adjusted to the market returns. And so people had hoards of cash in money market funds earning 5%. The view coming into the year was the Fed was going to cut. We'll get into the question of when they were going to cut. So that was attractive for bonds, as people might want to extend duration or buy equity, so that there was money being made just on general cash returns and that people would start looking to allocate. And so I think people were optimistic. I think what happened in the first quarter, which we've seen a couple times now, is we got a return that the reason why the market did what it did was it surprised people to the upside. Bitcoin ETF being one of those examples, NVIDIA being another example, were high flyer headline names that people were starting to say, oh, is this bubbly or is this a top? Just blew through people's expectations. NVIDIA did it on earnings and growth numbers, which is the AI generative computer story. And Bitcoin did it on the ETF launch. And the most bullish Bitcoin maxi never had the numbers that those funds have gotten into. Just to give context, the Bitcoin ETF, I believe, is the most successful, fastest growing product BlackRock's ever launched in the ETF space. I think they've launched over 400 ETFs. They've never seen anything like it. It's already over, I believe it's crossed $16 billion. The entire Bitcoin ETF complex is $50 billion plus. In March, it did $100 billion of trading volume. That is everyone on Wall Street's attention as a hot and attractive asset. So that was to the upside. And then the tech names also performed. So it was a great quarter. People were optimistic and they got another gift from the markets.
Yeah, you just ran through a bunch of really positive things. I want to zone in on one of the maybe more debatable, potentially negative things out there and just get your general sense of inflation. Is there a consensus on where inflation is going from here? We've certainly seen it in the economy, but just the pace of that and the trajectory as we look out the next 6, 12, 24 months?
Yeah. So inflation, they just did the print last week, was 3.5% for March, which was above expectations. And so the Fed's target is 2%. So we're about 150 basis points higher. With inflation and the Fed, I'll tell you what the consensus is based on what the markets is, but you ask anyone, everyone's got all these different opinions. I'd say the general view is that the price of goods is sticky and it's supposed to be coming down. So I don't think people are expecting it to rise. That would be a shock to the market. If inflation started to accelerate, that would really spook the market and be a big move. Right now, it's why isn't it coming down faster? And why is it staying so sticky at that 3.5% level? Lots of trying to connect dots, you did have a tremendous amount of stimulus in COVID. And I think that the part that I find the most interesting is that in a normal rate environment, people think this is high interest rates. This isn't even that high. But at 5% Fed funds, what's happening is you have people that have assets that are not levered. So you can split the economy into segments. But if you look at the wealthier, middle class and above, they have something like 80% of the mortgages are below 4%. They've got a money market fund paying 5%+. And so their assets are producing positive free cash flow for them, which is wonderful. So if you look at the money market industry, something I came from and follow closely, they now have $6 trillion in assets. So $6 trillion in money market funds earning 5%. That's a $300 billion annual stimulus to everyone's cash account. So even if wage inflation isn't rising, people who have assets are continuing to make money on their assets. The stock market's up. Their bond market portfolio is starting to look good. And so people are happy to continue spending. So consumer spending just hasn't abated. I think people thought that once the government checks stopped, the PPP loans, all of the federal stimulus tailed off, that eventually they would say that the consumer ran out of money. You saw during COVID was people suddenly had excess savings. They were home and they were buying lots of stuff. And that caused this inflation. So on one side of the fence, and this is getting weird because it does get quite political, but more of the liberal or Democrat economists where this is transitory, don't worry, it's not Biden's fault, go look this way. Obviously, the Republicans had a different view. But just in general economics, there was this, it's transitory coming from the government and it stayed longer than people thought. And that was supposedly coming from these checks. Well, those checks ran out, the savings rate came back to normal. So there was a lot of people that were like, I expect the economy to fall off a cliff, consumer spending to decline, and then the Fed will cut. This is where the markets get fun, is the bad news being good news. And the real question is, are risk assets rising because of the expectation that the Fed's going to cut rates, which is supposed to be stimulative to assets, or are risk assets rising just because people want to take more risk? And that's a big question that breaks a lot of people into two camps.
Do you think that there is a consensus on that specific point? You mentioned there's two camps, but do you think it's tilted one way or the other? Maybe it's worth the broader Fed conversation to happen now just in terms of that trajectory, but I'm curious where you stand on that.
So the question is, how much power does the Fed have? I did three interviews this quarter, I think, that involved the Fed. Mark Dow, who I love, who's a trader, he's a macro economist trained at the IMF and the Treasury, knows how banking pipes work. But he's really a fantastic trader. Jim Bianco, who's a market strategist, and George Robertson, who's an old school Wall Street trader. And they probably represent the spectrum. But it's the debate of, does the Fed have power or not over the markets? And the Fed is a whipping post for the markets. Every portfolio manager knows, just blame the Fed, or why didn't the market do what I said? Because the Fed messed it up. Every recession's been caused by the Fed. The Fed's just who you blame when stuff goes bad. I believe the Fed is trying its best to handle its mandate. The question is, does it really matter? How much power does the Fed have over money and sentiment of the market? And so the general idea goes that the way monetary policy works is that as rates rise, the cost of borrowing goes up, that decreases spending. That presumes that most of the spending is coming through some source of leverage, that we're using credit. So the real question, it's not so much the absolute rates. What I worry about, the thing that's most important to me, is where is leverage being built up and where is there excess leverage? Where are people getting over two over their skis? Because that's typically where some sort of crisis happens. My guess is the two places that I'm most curious about are private credit and commercial real estate, because those are areas that are harder to have transparent marks for a variety of reasons. Commercial real estate is private deals. You have big landlords. You have this idea of extend and pretend. I know nobody's coming to the office, but hey, will you roll your lease and not cancel it? And the bank's not wanting to foreclose because the bank doesn't want a $1 billion tower in Manhattan and be like, what are we going to do with this thing? So I think everyone's been like, why isn't commercial real estate rolling over? I think from poking around that space, I've learned it's a really big relationship business, that there aren't that many players, that people know they go through these cycles and they need to ride them out together, because you don't want to be the prisoner's dilemma who forecloses. Private credit, I think that there's some great private credit funds, but I haven't been to a finance conference where private credit wasn't the main attraction. people will send around stuff where there's company that has private debt and public debt. The public debt's getting hammered and the private debt's just staying there unmarked. So it does feel to me that the banks aren't pushing credit into the system. They're not expanding their balance sheets. They're not letting out mortgages willy-nilly. They're not doing anything. The banks are still rather tight. But perhaps we're getting that leverage demand in private credit where people are getting locked into illiquid deals and lending to things that otherwise wouldn't get credit. I don't have a smoking gun, but I'm always in search of where is the leverage being created. And so the question or the thought experiment is 5% actually restrictive? What if this isn't even that restrictive? And that 5% really isn't going to slow anything down. The economy is just going. And if people want to take risk, they're going to take risk. And you have this weird phenomenon happening where, based on the demographics of the country, that boomers or older population have assets, that when we raise rates, Einhorn talked about this 2 years ago, that as we raise rates, we're going to be giving a stimulus to the largest asset owners. And if you believe in the wealth effect, which is different than wage inflation, the wealth effect says, as your portfolio goes up, you spend more. I think most people can relate to this. If you bought Bitcoin at 20,000 and it goes to 70,000, maybe you're going to go on that trip and spend 10 grand to go on vacation. When Bitcoin crashes in your face, you're not so thrilled to throw some money around. And so as your stock portfolio starts to go up and you log on to your Fidelity or Schwab account and you see the number go up, you're like, yeah, we can renovate the house. We can build our own little shed in the back. We can do all these different things. And so the wealth effect is being the main driver of that consumer spend. And this is Bianco's argument, which is out of consensus. Jim Bianco's argument is actually the Fed needs to hike. So right now, I love these numbers of what the markets are saying, because that doesn't lie like words can. Right now, up until about a couple weeks ago, the belief was the Fed was going to cut in June. Now it's low probability of June, which will eventually probably be erased. And now the market's pushing out to September. So we just keep pushing the Fed rate because employment is doing well and inflation's still high. And so what are you cutting? And even though Powell is trying to keep the market at bay and not have a full out revolt, if I'm the Fed chairman, I'm not cutting rates. I'm not cutting rates in 24. Now, I don't know if I'd tell everyone I wasn't going to do that because it would cause a bit of chaos and you've got an election and nobody wants to look like you're doing something radical, but I don't know why the Fed's cutting rates. I'm not necessarily higher forever, but I'm higher for longer than most people think.
It's just an interesting, if you subscribe to the market connection, there's this circular reference where when you have the risk assets moving higher, and it does have a theoretical impact on potential rate cuts or rate hikes, but at the same time, the market is pricing that risk and driving those assets higher while taking a view on the potential for those rate hikes and rate cuts. So it's one of those fun games.
Well, to that point, I was just talking to my team about this. There's what you learn in textbooks, and there's what you learn on being on a trading desk, and then there's just reacting to the day's news. Just this past week, the 10-year widened 20 basis points, and the NASDAQ's up. So there's this notion that just basic finance, that you're just discounting cash flows. It's all you're ever doing is, if I give you a dollar today, whether I buy a stock, a bond, a token, am I going to get more dollars in the future? And the best person to walk through this is Aswath Damodaran, and those episodes are my favorite. I've taken his class several times. I love it. But it's how finance should work. What's the cash flows and discounting back? And the theory goes that equity is exactly long duration, meaning that they're very sensitive to rates. So if rates fall, then the price of those tech earnings that are so attractive should go up because you're discounting a lower rate and the value of the company, which means vice versa, that when rates rise and you can now earn 5% in your bond portfolio, those equity prices should drop to give them an equity risk premium. That's the balance of how this is all supposed to work. But rates rose and NASDAQ performed and people want to pull their hair out. And that gets to the point of really what you're doing is deciding how much risk you want to take at any given time. So the market is definitely in a risk on pace. It's aware of concerns. It's not like we're not yet in the roaring 20s, but we feel like we're just stuck in the seventh inning where, yeah, there's going to be more, but the market starts to look out forward and go, well, we all know what happens in the eighth and ninth inning. And then what happens after that? And people are generally skeptical, but that's a healthy market. And my favorite thing is when no one's really thrilled and everyone's making money, that's a good market. When everyone's making money and everyone thinks they're a genius, that's a dangerous market. When everyone's terrified and thinks that it's the worst, that's the best market.
Yeah, I think you phrased that very well there. One of the dynamics recently is that the IPO market has opened up, or so it seems. Any commentary just on what's going on there?
So this gets back to this private public conflict. We talked about private credit, but the same thing is happening in private equity where companies are choosing to stay private longer. So it used to be that a company raised money, maybe from venture capital, they bootstrapped, they started to grow, they got bigger. And then once they really were at a sufficient mature level, they would go public because that would be the value unlock. What we saw, and part of this was maybe the low interest rate environment and valuations going to the moon, is that companies stayed private longer. The argument was that they were getting higher valuations, that they had a much longer thesis, that the private investors were more patient and they weren't having to mark to quarterly. They really had these long-term visions. And so you had this big companies just not coming to the market. And so the public markets weren't benefiting. Reddit being the big name one, but then I think Pfizer did a spinoff. There's been a couple others. So in March, we had three or four IPOs. And I was talking to one of the heads of a major bank's IPO desk, and they're really looking at it as, is this a bellwether to do more? How are these deals performing? How are they being received? Do the public, the Wellingtons and the Fidelities and the T. Rowe's, are they ready for new issue? And that's a good thing. The market's been closed and thawed, and that will lead to valuations. I think the public markets corrected a lot faster and maybe at all relative to private markets. And so the question is, do we see that as a trend, or is that just a one-time blip? We got a couple of deals, and then we go back to the best way to raise value as an owner is to stay in the private markets and avoid the public markets.
Just in general, like making markets is the show, and thinking about market structure over the past 15 years, I started my career slightly later than you, but it was still a different time in the mid early 2000s versus where we are today. With what you mentioned previously, there was so much of this private credit was held on bank balance sheets. Global financial crisis moves a lot of that off. You also have the dynamics in venture capital where you have these bigger businesses just created. I think there's more funding from venture just in general. And when you think about that being a change that happened along with low interest rates, how much do you think is truly secular change where there's going to be more depth in private markets, more liquidity, I guess, in theory in private markets, just more dollars going in versus how much of that was cyclical with the interest rate environment?
I think you're right that it's secular. When we started on Wall Street in the early 2000s, hedge funds were still king. They made a lot of money. And then we had the advent of the algo trading shops and long short equity. I mean, it's crazy how long short equity and hedge fund space as a vehicle, it's just not what it was. It used to be so popular. It was a top selling product, but we've seen that before. Long only mutual funds, when I was in high school, giving money to Peter Lynch at Magellan paid for my college. And that was the thing. But we didn't have Reg FD or inside information. And then that went away. And then long short equity was king. So you go through phases with vehicles. And I think it's because the markets are efficient. I love studying all markets. That's one of the beauties of making markets. And you see a lot of trends, which is that there's an edge. People exploit the edge. Then they charge large fees for the edge. Then the edge goes away. And it's really the people running the products that are making the money and not the people who hold them. And then there's a pursuit of what's next. The thing about private equity and private credit is the attraction to it, it is relationship-based. Not anyone can do those deals. You can't just call someone up and buy a company. You can't call someone up and have access to a loan. The question is, what is the capacity for that strategy and what are the ramifications? So if you're lending to HVAC companies in the middle of the country, I don't know, maybe that's a really great business model and everyone loves it, but you know it from us both being credit guys. What I wonder is, but you lend money to Home Depot, you're looking at capital structure and the balance sheet, but you and I could do that pretty quickly. If I threw you six HVAC companies, how long would it take you to do the diligence on all of them? And then how fast is the money coming? What's the velocity of money into the asset class? And how are they doing diligence? And if they go bad, maybe it doesn't matter. Maybe they're like, it works. The problem that I have with credit is it's not a game to win big. It's a game to usually protect and play. And so the problem is, if you are playing a game like that and you have some weird thing that happens and a bunch of defaults and workouts, does the returns really work? So I think there are some super interesting funds that are going to do really well like anything, but I definitely think it's a secular trend where we just keep pushing out we keep pushing out two things. One, the source of capital, and two, the source of ideas. The source of capital is definitely going into the larger wealth management space. So before, this was an institution and pension game, but they have their exposure, they have their playbooks. They're not growing beyond the GDP. They are what they are. You either get a deal from CalPERS or Harvard or Northwestern, or you don't. And they're tinkering at the edges, but everyone copied. If you go back and you look at Yale and David Swensen, the OG of how this all even started, he was the one who first argued, because everyone was allocating to long-only public markets, I could have an edge by going private. Well, when everyone goes private, that edge gets eroded and all these people chased Yale's returns, which were amazing. But he was doing something that was out of consensus. It was a contrarian bet. It's no longer contrarian to have alts in your pension or your endowment. So that market's saturated. So now what are you seeing? You're seeing this push into wealth management. And so for wealthy individuals, to them, they couldn't get access to KKR or Apollo or Millennium. And now it's like, whoa, do you want access? But those are amazing firms, top tier investors. But I don't know, is the 27th fund the same thing as the first fund? How do you get that? So there's just a deep push into alt, and they have a new base. The same, by the way, was circular to the same thing. This wealthy boomer and younger generation has a lot of assets. They're looking for uncorrelated returns. The cool thing about privates, and Cliff Asness's head would explode, is they don't mark them. So if you don't mark your assets as frequently as a public market, it's going to be naturally uncorrelated. Is it truly? It's hard to say. But wealthy people like it. So a new source of capital with a new structure. But again, nothing's really new on Wall Street. Maybe I call it a repackaged structure to a new market that's growing. Like anything, it will do well for a while. Some people make a lot of money, and then I'm sure we'll be on to the next thing.
The new source of capital being that wealth managers and just targeting that specific investor class, is that a growing pie relative to the endowment and traditional LP base? It's something I really don't know, but it's an interesting point.
Oh, yeah. No, it's huge. So that's the market that we spend a lot of time focused on. Wealth management continues to grow year over year. There's a battle between who has the money. So like the big wirehouses, like the Morgan Stanley's and the Merrill Lynch, the Goldman Sachs are the biggest. But what ends up happening is you have advisors that leave, they start their own shop, they build a firm, and they're an independent. And then those independents sometimes come together and they're aggregated under bigger RIA platforms. But in general, as people's wealth increases, there's just a shift towards professionally managed in some fashion. The life cycle of wealth looks like this. You start a job, you get a 401k, you put some money away. Then you're like, I have kids. Maybe I should think about a 529. You're in the accumulation phase. You want to pay your mortgage. You're hopefully saving and putting money away. But then what ends up happening is you're in your 40s or your 50s. Now your wealth's actually getting pretty big. A lot of those liabilities are taken care of. Your house is taken care of. Maybe the second house, college is paid off, and you're starting to think about your future. And now you're in your highest earning years. So you get your highest earning years, and now you're like, well, when can I retire? Do I have enough is one of the biggest questions. And what will my life look like? And that's where a lot of people want to seek a financial professional. And even in finance, I see people do this. Some of it's about markets and allocation of assets, but a lot of it's about the certainty, or as close as they can get to the knowledge of what would my life look like if we had this much, or if I retire in 10 years. And so that moment, and obviously where we are in the demographics, is a lot more people are seeking advice of some sort. A secondary point to that, but why I think Bitcoin matters so much, not just because of crypto part, but just why Wall Street people call a lot and ask me about it, is that's their best hook at that next generation. The Gen X and the Gen Zs now have this asset class, and they're hoping that that the finance is a really long game. And you want to make sure when they have those 50-year-olds, that sweet spot of wealth and advice, that you've already built a relationship with them. A 20-year-old trading on Robinhood, well, the fear is, do they care who their 401k provider is? Do they care who their parents used? And so everyone's playing for that. That's great. They already have the boomers' wealth. That's going wonderful for the financial services industry. How do they get that next generation when they go to personal advice? And so it's a huge business. It continues to grow. There's a huge tailwind in the independent advice space because of service models. There's obviously a cost benefit. This is always a fun thing too, is what type of advice do you get for the level of assets you have? So if you're on the ultra high net worth, you have more than 100 million, there's people banging down the door to do everything for you. If you're in the 50 to 100 million, there's a different thing. a lot of wealth in America is in that $1 to $10 million range, call it. And they want advice and they have questions and they need a service model. And what happened with the big providers is when they look at the margins of the accounts, they're always trying to go for the big accounts. So there's a balance there of how that market's served. You saw people try to go down the robo path to kind of solve this. It works in some ways, it doesn't work in others. That's a trend I'm betting on, that the continued shift towards some level of financial advice will continue.
Yeah, the whales and the minnows and where you fit into all of that. On the robo-advisors and just the fee dynamics in that market in general, have those come down in the same way that you've seen it compress in the traditional hedge fund and institutional fund class?
Well, so we worked in different worlds. So your high fees and my high fees are very different. You were charging people 2 and 20. I was charging 40. And so they're very different. So yeah, they've come down. But I think what you've seen is that in the hedge fund space, you'll get to 1 in 10. They still charge 2 in 20. They've just adopted that their assets aren't going to grow anymore. So they're not going to experience both high fees and high growth. And it's not really worth going to 50 basis points because how many more assets are you going to pull into your strategy? So very similar on the public side, you see a push towards lower fees, but then there's kind of a sound barrier of there's a cost to run a business, there's data feeds, you can't go below certain numbers. So fee compression is a thing that will always be in the financial services space. But I think that the future really is about just customization and tax optimization. That's the area that I've spent all my time on. If I look at the secular trends, when we started in the business, we were ending the high alpha, high fee phase and entering the low fee passive phase.
Great time.
Yeah, exactly. So the low fee passive phase really changed. It was a great product and it solves a lot of problems, but it doesn't solve everyone's problems. And the growth of customization and tax optimization and access. So I think that when I look at the industry, one of the things they're interested in is customization, tax optimization, and alternative assets. The alts being the new thing. And so that's one area that people are really focused on is, should we use alts? How should we use alts? Who should use alts? When do they make sense? How do we think about allocating to them? Because that's a differentiator. Tax optimization is a differentiator. And customization across families and generations is a differentiator. And so it's a much more robust conversation than, look, there's still stock jockey brokers that are buying individual stocks and being like, I'm going to buy NVIDIA and I'm going to sell this. But I think that that's the consistent trend across financial services.
What are the milestones for Bitcoin from here? And I have a note about Bitcoin halving that you'll need to explain to me. So add that into any other milestones that might be upcoming.
So the ETF was the big milestone because, as we talked about it many times on these, it was the coronation of the asset class as part of the Wall Street complex. Some people don't like that because it's being co-opted by the evil Wall Street people. But if it's going to be an asset adopted as part of asset allocation, then this is the path it has to take. I think you're seeing it take a path beyond what people's wildest expectation was. So that's a huge milestone and a big positive moment for it. The question then becomes the adoption of crypto larger, but to answer your specific on Bitcoin and the halving. So every 4 years, the way that the Bitcoin protocol was launched, the amount that miners make from mining a block of Bitcoin and posting it on the blockchain, they get paid in Bitcoins. It halves every 4 years. It's 6.25 Bitcoin per block right now. So if you mine a block, so a bunch of computers are fighting against each other and it's not really complex. They're all just guessing a number from a random number generator, and whoever gets the number the lowest, the fastest, gets the answer, essentially. That miner will get that Bitcoin. And that happens every 10 minutes. So every 10 minutes, 6.25 Bitcoin are emitted to the Bitcoin network. So supply is increasing, not very fast. But the halving means every 4 years, that reward drops. So the next one will be 3.125.
Was the methodology originally just that we need to pay more in order to get this system off the ground, and then once it's at scale, we can be paying less?
Well, it was kind of brilliant because, I mean, the whole thing is absolutely brilliant. It's mythological because we'll never know who Satoshi is or was as a group.
Never say never.
But they built a system that they really thought about things for the long term of how would we want the system to evolve. And part of it was, okay, we want to make sure that we have 10 minutes between each block to make sure everything's right and that we never have questions of corruption and immutability. as the network gets used more and more and this gets more adopted, what would that cost to do that work? And so they just told everyone what they were going to do. So the difference specifically on this point with the Fed versus Bitcoin as a monetary authority is everyone in the world knows exactly what's going to happen. There's no, you might cut and you're not parsing tea leaves at a Fed meeting and be like, what did he mean by that? Everyone knows exactly how the game is going to be played. And they wrote it out on day one. And the comparison to that, to give people context, would be that we once told people you could convert your dollars to gold, that there would be a finite resource and you would have convertibility of dollars to gold. This is the game. And then we were like, we're changing the game. Now, the US dollar is the most powerful currency. I don't know why this is weird, but I'm both a diehard American capitalist, think the US dollar will be the strongest currency forever, and love Bitcoin. I think you can say all three things. A lot of people that like Bitcoin on the premise that the dollar is going to collapse. I'm just not one of those people. But the rules do change, and they are subject to politicians, and they are subject to government officials. That will move around. Whereas Bitcoin, when we make our 10-year episode for Making Markets, we'll know exactly the Bitcoin emission rate will be and how many Bitcoin there will be, and it won't be a surprise.
Does it have any actual impact on the market itself? Like, do you see less miners?
So there's pricing moves and then the risk to miners. These go together. If the price doesn't move, your payment for mining just got halved. So that's really bad for the mining industry. What you've seen at the past three halvings, the price dropped the year before, and then going into the halving, the price rises again. It's a market. It brings it forward. It knows it's going to happen. And then the year before, it usually underperforms or is flat. And then the year of the halving, it goes up, because if there's demand and there's less supply, the market goes up and the miners basically sort themselves out. You can have creative destruction amongst the miners, but the market usually considers it very bullish. So if the ETF demand stays where it is, which is incredible, and you have less supply coming onto market, it's a very bullish setup for Bitcoin.
Yeah, the way you described it, it's almost like a stock split in some ways of the market adjusts. But those miners...
Splits drive me fucking nuts. It's not a split. They're not just dividing their price.
I'm just saying how this thing should trade.
The company announced they're no longer going to issue more equity. So they've been issuing equity every clip, and they're like, we're going to issue half as much equity. Everyone should be happy because you're being diluted less.
Yes. There's a market adjustment was what I'm going for. Sorry for making the apples to apples.
I just think splits are so funny. Is split not the funniest thing? Justin says markets are efficient. You ever seen a stock split?
Well, in fairness, if it keeps you on the exchange, if you trade on the NASDAQ, that allows for more funds to own your stock. Therefore, there's a deeper buyer base and ownership base.
Oh my God, that's the most banker answer ever.
Well, I mean, there's some logic to it. Once something gets added to an index, that opens up a world of possibilities. It's the same thing as getting your credit rating.
Okay, fair. When I bought Berkshire in advance of the split for the BNF, that's one of my favorite trades, was buying Berkshire stock before the BNFS deal.
Yeah.
But that's a big stock.
I'm talking more reverse splits.
All right, that's different.
Yeah.
I'm talking about when they take a stock from like 100, they split 10 for one, they're like, it's $10. And people are like, oh my God, you can buy it at $10. That to me is the most inefficient example of markets.
Well, you behavioral economics, I think we've thrown all of that out the window. And we have to understand that these buyers are not always rational. You could get a leather bag from the store, and you can get another leather bag that's 10x as much. Demand for all these things.
Yes.
I think we ran through the majority of my topics. One of the last things I wanted to close out on is the 6-month anniversary of Making Markets. We talked about the 2-year anniversary of the quarterly recaps, but the 6-month anniversary of Making Markets. You talked about some of the episodes, which is pretty neat when you get the debates where you can represent each person and the various points of view. But any other takeaways as you've shifted into the broader markets over time?
Oh, I love it. It's been so fun because it's just aligned with how I think about the world, that anyone who's taking risk, it's all the same stuff. We have different lingos and different topics, but it's just such a fun place to discuss how markets work. We're going to release an episode on horse racing, how people trade horses, wine, watches, bonds, crypto, real estate, farmland. It's all just so fascinatingly consistent. There's a supply question, there's demand, there's edge, there's analytics, there's market structure. I think market structure is the one that I probably like more than most people, of just how it works. There's brokers and there's different agents involved and middlemen. And there's all these just markets everywhere. And when we were younger, we would buy stock tickers and watch them. And I remember just telling my dad, this is all legalized gambling. He's like, no, it's not. I'm like, nope, it's gambling. It's just speculating. Thing goes up, goes down. IBM had a great quarter and they did all these good things and their stock went down. How is this not just legalized gambling? And I spent my whole life trying to get into the industry to do it. And then I learned it. And it's like, I don't know if my views change that much being an 8-year-old kid, that people, anytime you're making guess on the future events, there's a level of speculation. And that's been my big theme of how I've had really been fortunate to get opportunities, is that not to be so mired down in a view. And I think making markets is my hope to show people that, look, they're all the same thing. You're buying cars on your lot, you're taking inventory risk, you're deciding what you think the consumer is going to buy, you're planting grapevines in the ground and waiting for 10 years for this to work. You think people are going to want Cabernet and not want Merlot, and you're making these guesses. And that's not different than telling me what NVIDIA is going to do next quarter. You have no idea either. No one does. Nobody knows anything. And the best risk takers know they know nothing. And what they're doing is just constantly looking around, obsessively curious about how things work. And then when they see something that they're like, oh, I think this might actually work, they swing and they swing hard. And it just doesn't matter. And so the fact that we've gotten to do a broadening of that has just been an absolute blast. So thank you for helping me do this. It's been a lot of fun.
I have the easy job. I just completely agree with you on everything you just mentioned. It's that interest that just spans across asset classes and all these different things. So it's its own little ecosystem, but it hums into all the other ecosystems. Well, it's a pleasure as always. Congrats on our 2 years.
Wow.
Champagne.
We'll see you in 2 years. Thank you very much, Matt. This has been fun. If you enjoyed this episode, check out joincolossus.com. There you will find every episode of this podcast, along with transcripts, our weekly newsletter, and resources to continue your learning.